Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back to our program. I'm Mark Bayshore. It is a Wednesday edition of the program. Eight U.S. states, including Michigan, have thrown their support to one small Wisconsin city. Yesterday, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder and his fellow Great Lakes governors voted to approve a request from the city of Waukesha, Wisconsin, to divert up to 8.2 million gallons of water daily directly from Lake Michigan. Waukesha is, of course, a suburb of Milwaukee that straddles the Great Lakes Basin. Its own municipal water supply is contaminated by radium, and the EPA required the community to find another source. The agreement is the first of its kind in the Great Lakes region. It's regarded as the most vigorous test of the Great Lakes Compact. So far, that's the 2008 agreement that laid out a process to decide such issues. For reaction and analysis, we were going to speak with two guests today, and hopefully we still will. We're trying to connect with Mr. Grant Trigger. Mr. Trigger represented Michigan and the Snyder administration on a panel that was studying Waukesha's request. We will continue our attempts to connect with him. For now, we'll turn to our go-to guy regarding Great Lakes environmental stories, Gary Wilson. Gary, good morning.
Hey, Mark. Good morning.
All I can say is, whew, W-H-E-W. Wow, it's fine. The vote is finally over. Did the outcome surprise you, or were you expecting this?
Yeah, we've been talking about this, you and I, for a long time.
Indeed.
The vote did not surprise me. There was a lot of controversy, as you've mentioned, about this whole issue. But as I saw it unfold, and once the regional body, that's the group designated by the governors to dissect this thing and come up with findings, on which the governors would base their decision, as I watched that unfold in the various meetings over the last 2 months, I could see that there was a lot of rigor in the process, and they were really going through every paragraph, every line, every comma, parsing every word. So as they did that, and they got rid of that big issue, the service area, whereby Waukesha was requesting water for towns that border it that don't really have a need, once they got rid of that, I was pretty sure it would pass. Now, Minnesota turned out to be, sort of an outlier. They were fairly withholding during all this. But in the end, they came around too. So I'm not surprised, and I think it was the best decision.
In your view, what were the major factors that enabled not just approval here, but it required unanimity? It required an 8-0 vote. One no vote would have killed the request. What were the most compelling particular factors in determining approval of this request?
Well, the Waukesha scaled its request back, as I mentioned, to eliminate this service area, Waukesha and the state of Wisconsin. They reduced the quantity, and over the course of Waukesha's application, going back 5 years or even longer, when it started, Waukesha had what I would call a fairly elitist attitude. They were, kind of silent on conservation. They didn't want to make that a priority. They didn't really want to return the water that they took from the Great Lakes back to the Great Lakes, which is a requirement. But as the thing evolved over the years, they saw that that was going to be a no sale. So Waukesha adjusted their thinking, adjusted their application, and changed their public persona on this to make it more palatable. This was never going to be popular. But Waukesha changed their proposal, and the state of Wisconsin helped them over the years to give it a chance. And then when it got into the nitty-gritty, as the state started to raise various objections, Waukesha and Wisconsin, they responded and they defended their position, but they also went out of their way to be collaborative at the last minute. So at the end of the day, it all came out, and again, I think it came out as it should have.
I'm curious what you think the broader public will conclude about the process itself. I mean, the Great Lakes Compact was passed in 2008, fully 8 years ago. It seems like yesterday, but it was 8 years ago. Will the public conclude that the process is sound, or could cynics prevail and could doubts about the Great Lakes Compact continue into the future?
Boy, Mark, your question is right on the mark. The public has been adamantly opposed to this, and based on a lot of emotion, and some of it justified. Nobody wants to see Great Lakes water leave the basin, even though this will be returned as treated wastewater. It's an emotional issue. It's a hot-button issue. And there's been a lot of misinformation out there over the years about, oh, the sky is going to fall, Phoenix and California will be knocking on our door next to get Great Lakes water if we give it to Waukesha. Those things won't happen. So I think the public will retain some cynicism about this. But if they really dig into the issues and they look at the facts and they look at the law with an objective head on, I think they can come around. And there's a wild card in this, and this is the environmental groups who have been pushing hard right up to yesterday, fighting this thing. I think if they get out of their opposition mode and deal with the realities, they can help the public understand that this process really did have a lot of rigor, and the best decision, the governors of the 8 states, and Michigan was right on point with this whole process, really did make the best decision.
Well, in the end, the diversion request that was approved did get a little bit more support from these environmental groups, did it not?
Depends on which groups you look at. The Wisconsin contingent put out a statement yesterday that they, you know, remain adamantly opposed to this decision, and that they're going to continue to monitor it. And their statement was not remotely conciliatory. Some of the other groups, National Wildlife Federation, based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, was a little bit more cautious in their statements. They acknowledged the concessions that Waukesha made, and they said it proved that the this is Mark Smith speaking for the National Wildlife Federation. It proved that the process is going to be hard, that the bar has been set pretty high. And that said, they're going to continue to monitor the compact and Waukesha and Wisconsin's behavior for compliance. So Mark Smith with the National Wildlife Federation was a little bit more circumspect. But there are others out there. The mayor's organization, Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, yesterday after the meeting, Dave Ulrich, the executive director there, he was adamant that this was wrong. So we'll see how it plays out.
Again, we are speaking with Gary Wilson, current state's Great Lakes commentator and Great Lakes journalist. We're trying to connect here with Grant Trigger to make him a part of the program. Mr. Trigger represented Michigan and the Snyder administration on a panel that was studying Waukesha's request. I'm told we may have connected with Grant Trigger. Grant Trigger, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
Very good. Very good. We've got kind of an iffy connection. I'm going to ask Gary Wilson to stand by here and also join the conversation. Did this outcome surprise you, or were you expecting it?
You know, that's a good question. I think throughout this process, there have been a lot of great questions asked and a lot of effort spent to make sure we got the right answers. So in the end, I think it was a successful process. And from Michigan's perspective, we have a unanimous vote supporting this outcome. That's quite an achievement.
Let me ask you a question. I just ran by Gary Wilson a minute ago. I mean, this required a unanimous vote. I mean, one no vote would have killed this thing. But it strikes me that you can look at an 8-0 vote in a couple of different ways, I think. I mean, you might defend the soundness of Waukesha's case, but a cynic might also conclude that the law of averages would have meant one no vote, which would have killed the whole deal. My broader question is this. Do you think the broader public will conclude that the process contained in the Great Lakes Compact is sound, or could the cynics prevail and could doubts about the Great Lakes Compact linger into the future?
I think that the 8-0 vote is a substantial reflection of the quality of the review process, because you don't get the unanimous vote unless you've thoughtfully addressed the concerns that everybody brings to the table. From Michigan's perspective, we engaged with all of the stakeholders. We engaged with tribal leadership. We listened to the concerns that everybody had substantively, and we felt in the end all of those issues were appropriately addressed, as did all the other jurisdictions.
Critics of this arrangement, one of whom we had on this program just last week, have been fearing that approval means more diversion requests. What do you think?
I think that if anybody tracked this process and saw how thorough the review was, you would never expect anybody faint of heart to even attempt this. Waukesha has spent years putting their application together. Wisconsin has spent years making sure that it was done correctly, and we did a very thorough review of all the criteria. So no one's going to get approved unless they go through a thorough process and expect to be very closely reviewed by the Compact Council. And in this case, we imposed a series of conditions to ensure that what's being done will be done properly.
I think it's sometimes gotten overlooked as well that Waukesha will be paying significant sums of money for infrastructure. I guess that number exceeds $200 million, and this is in addition to the various hoops that they were obligated to jump through just through the process itself. So there's a price tag, there's a dollar price tag associated with infrastructure, at the very least.
Now, Mark, I would just throw into that, and somebody can fact check this number for me, but I think Waukesha has invested, I want to say $5 million in consulting fees and lawyers' fees over the course of this process. So it's not for the faint of heart financially.
We're talking with Gary Wilson, Great Lakes journalist and commentator for Current State, along with Mr. Grant Trigger, who represented Michigan and the Snyder administration on a panel that was studying Waukesha's request and about a month ago recommended approval of this plan. Let's dig into one other main criticism of the plan here. I mean, the Michigan Environmental Council and others have maintained that that Waukesha did not explore vigorously enough alternatives to the Lake Michigan plan. For listeners who hear that, Grant Trigger, and they're trying to understand that, what should they keep in mind?
Well, in fact, they started with a review between Waukesha and the state of Wisconsin of 14 alternatives. They narrowed it down to 6. They reviewed all those at length. And I think where the big issue has come up in the end was the contention by some that, well, they could have continued to pump this groundwater and continued to treat it. The challenges with that, however, are many. Right now, the water that they pump is contaminated with radioactive radium. Once you remove it from the ground, you have an inevitable consequence. You have to put it someplace. You can't destroy it. So they take it out of the ground, they treat the water, and they create a radioactive waste that has to be disposed of. The only alternative that leaves the radium in the ground is taking water from Lake Michigan. That's the first thing. The second thing that's really became in the end a very compelling issue is that currently Waukesha diverts over 500 million gallons of water a year from the Great Lakes Basin into the Mississippi River. So by approving this request, you stop the diversion, you stop extracting radium-contaminated groundwater, and the people in Waukesha have a clean water supply. So when you look at the alternatives, in the end, this alternative that was approved is the only one that stops the current diversion. It avoids harm to wetlands and other surface water bodies in the Waukesha area, and it stops radium from getting into the environment. Those are pretty compelling reasons to say that the alternative that's selected was the right one.
Supporters of the plan have also claimed that under the plan, Waukesha would be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I've got this right, supporters claim that Waukesha will be returning more water to Lake Michigan than it takes. That's accurate, correct?
That's correct. With this plan, all the water they withdraw from Lake Michigan gets returned to Lake Michigan with a potential variation in dry weather conditions. Whereas now, we're losing over 1.6 million gallons a day out of the Great Lakes.
Gary Wilson, I don't want to exclude you from asking Grant Trigger a question here. If you've got one, I'll continue here. I've got other ones, but if you've got one, jump right in.
Well, I would I've talked to Grant quite a bit, especially during the last couple of months here as this process unfolded. and all the meetings that the regional body that that Grant was on with the other states, and I would add two Canadian provinces until yesterday, were open to the public. All the information was available on websites. You could watch literally the process, the findings document being edited right in front of you if you wanted to. That's a big plus. There have been some suggestions, especially in the last few days, about the process lacking some transparency, about there should have been another public comment session. I think those are crutches for people who came out on the losing end of this, because I sat through these meetings, and everybody on that regional body was accessible. Grant was accessible. I had a long conversation with the representative from New York. You could approach anybody and ask anybody a question, and you know, within reason, they would give you an answer. So I think Grant, Michigan, and the region have a strong basis to stand by this process.
Grant Trigger, I've heard no one refer to an appeal of this decision. Is an appeal possible?
You know, it is legally possible, but one of the things that I think that all the members on the council were dedicated to was a very thorough, thoughtful process. And from Michigan's perspective, it was important to go in and get it right. We had dozens of people engaged in the review process. We looked at each of the criteria in detail. And in the end, if you do a good job and your results are supported, you should be able to defend it from whomever is unhappy with the result. We think it was a thoughtful process, and we'll defend it as necessary.
We want to thank both of our guests. Grant Trigger represented Michigan and the Snyder administration on a panel that was studying the request to divert Great Lakes water to the city of Waukesha, Wisconsin. That request was, of course, formally approved by Great Lakes governors yesterday. Also, thank you to Great Lakes journalist and current state commentator Gary Wilson. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Thanks,
Mark.
And coming up on Current State, Helping Women, Period, is a local nonprofit whose mission is to help ensure that all women have the products they need when they need them. They supply shelters, food banks, and homeless organizations with feminine hygiene items, and they'll be our guests for Neighbors in Action coming up. Residents in a number of Michigan cities, including Lansing, Jackson, Kalamazoo, and Detroit, can occasionally see a once-endangered bird in their midst. In urban settings, peregrine falcons nest and breed high in city structures. In downtown Jackson, the birds occupy a space up in the Tower Building. The county website offers a great opportunity for people to view the birds on its 3-megapixel digital camera. Recently, I spoke with two people who know a lot about peregrines in Michigan. Steve Shotwell owns and operates a business near the Tower Building in Jackson. He's also chairman of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. I first asked him how long the raptors have been nesting in Jackson.
We can confirm nesting since 2008.
And how many young falcons have been born there? Is that known?
Yes, it is. We've had 21 fledged, and then this year's birth, and at the moment we have 3 chicks up there right now, and the babies themselves, so this will be 24.
How many young per year typically hatch and survive?
Well, in Jackson, we typically have between 3 and 5. We've had up to 5 hatch, but we've always fledged, it seems, between 3 and 4, which is a little better than the national average.
And how does it work in the nesting area itself here? Do the young go off and find their own homes, or does the I understand the DNR gets involved with the chicks. Why don't we start there? What do they do?
Well, the DNR will come in here sometime between the 1st of June and Father's Day weekend, and they will band the birds. They will check their eyes. They will get blood samples and DNA information on the birds so they can keep track of them. And then they band the birds, and that information is then sent to Cornell University, as well as kept here with our Michigan DNR to track the birds.
But where do those young birds go? Do they fly off and make their own nests or what?
Typically, the peregrine falcon will migrate to in the south, somewhere along the Gulf Coast, typically spend its first 1 or 2 years down there, and then come back to the Midwest and nest. Our pair, Chaitin and Big Red, one is from Ohio and one's from Minnesota. So they paired up, obviously, down south and came up and explored the different nesting areas.
Hmm.
And Big Red came from a large family herself. She was in a clutch of six babies, and her mother would typically have between 5 and 7 eggs, and she's had typically between 4 and 6 eggs.
Here in Lansing, we've got peregrines nesting on a smokestack at the local utility here, the Lansing Board of Water and Light, and also in the Bogey Tower, a 23-story building downtown. Tell us, where exactly do the birds nest in the tower building?
They nest on what would be the southeastern corner of the tower building, and we have 4 large parapets that surround the top of it, which put a wall or a border. So our chicks are not at risk of blowing out or being knocked out by storms. A lot of times what happens is when they're nesting in the boxes and in those areas, it can be difficult for the chicks to fledge all the way because they don't have a big enough area to stretch their wings and that type of activity, which is needed for the birds.
Steve Shotwell is chairman of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. He also owns and operates a business in downtown Lansing, not far from the Tower Building, where since about 2008 or so, peregrine falcons have nested and bred. Describe a peregrine for us, Steve. What is most notable about these birds?
Well, these are a large bird. They're the second largest predatory bird. And they're what we call a pinnacle predator, which means that they're at the top of the food chain. And typically a peregrine will be around 12 to 14 inches tall. And the female is larger than the male. And the nesting area is selected typically from where they nested as a child. Some of the information and studies on the peregrines have shown that if you nested on a building, your first choice is to nest on a building yourself if you were born on a building. So it's a very interesting program.
Mm. I think some number of people know that peregrines can dive at a very high rate of speed. Tell us about that.
Well, they are the fastest North American animal. They will dive at almost, they've been clocked at diving at over 180 miles an hour. And this has been shown, you can see this quite often. You know, you'll be walking around downtown and all of a sudden feathers will start fluttering down and you'll realize that a collision had occurred somewhere above you. And so it makes for interesting afternoons in downtown. There's a lot of nice cafes you can sit at and watch the birds fly in and out. And so, yeah, it makes for a good experience.
And I know you can do the same thing in downtown Lansing here,
yes.
Certainly at the Bogey Building, for one. We've got a clip of a peregrine, and then actually what you'll hear is a single peregrine falcon and then a pair of peregrines. Let's have a listen. See, one final question here. Is the intention here for the peregrines to live in the tower building indefinitely?
Yeah, it's a two-stage program. Also, we've tied it in with our strategic plan of education, and we've made the live feed available in the classrooms in Jackson County. And I've had the opportunity this past 2 weeks ago to give a presentation to the science class at East Jackson High School, where the kids were able to actually see the live footage and witness Big Red feeding the children. So that was part of our whole idea, was to to share the experience with the youth of Jackson County and get a better picture of what nature is all about.
You can get a great angle on these birds on the county of the Jackson County website, a 3-megapixel digital camera. I recommend it if for our listeners who are interested in birds. We've been talking about downtown Jackson's nesting peregrine falcons with Steve Shotwell, a downtown Jackson business owner and chairman of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you very much, and enjoy your day.
And to learn more about the bigger picture involving peregrine falcons here in Michigan, let's turn to Karen Cleveland. Karen is a bird biologist for the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
How many Michigan cities have peregrines nesting in them today? Do you know?
Well, it's kind of interesting because we have some cities that have multiple nest sites in them, but statewide we had 33 active nests last year, and only about a half dozen of those were on natural sites. The rest were all on man-made locations, and that ranged all the way from Houghton up in the UP down to Monroe down in the southern Lower Peninsula.
Now, I know DNR placed some peregrines in city skyscrapers back in beginning, I think, in the mid-80s. As these birds die off, does DNR have to restock these spaces, or do other birds just move in and take them over?
We actually did the last releases of peregrine falcons on sites back in 1992. So all the birds that you're seeing out on the landscape right now, those are, for the most part, wild hatched birds. In Canada, they are still doing some of these bird releases going on in some locations as they're trying to get birds back. But the rest of these birds are all hatched in the wild from somewhere in the Midwest, could be Ontario even.
Besides cities, where will a peregrine falcon nest?
Well, their natural habitat is actually to be nesting on cliff ledges. And so in certain parts of the country, you still see a lot of that kind of activity going on. In Michigan, historically, most of that activity was going on in the UP, a lot of it along the lake shores. And we do actually have some of that that's happening again in Michigan now, which is kind of exciting.
I know peregrines all but disappeared 40 or 50 years ago due to DDT and PCBs. How firmly reestablished is the peregrine falcon in Michigan today?
Well, to kind of put it in perspective, what we think we had for numbers in pre-settlement times was probably in the neighborhood of about 10 to 15 pairs. And again, these are the natural cliff sites, which we don't have a lot of. Right now, we had 33 nesting pairs last year in Michigan. Again, the bulk of them are on these man-made sites that weren't available before we came and settled the state and built these wonderful man-made cliffs for them. But we're doing really well, and a lot of the building managers that have peregrines really love that the birds are there and are really taking care of a lot of pigeon problems for them.
So, well, you anticipated my next question. I was going to ask you what they feed on. They feed on pigeons?
Well, they basically feed on lots of birds. One of their nicknames is duck hawk because they're actually known for taking waterfowl on the wing. Basically, anything that's a mallard or a merganser size or smaller, they will actually try to take from the air. And what's kind of exciting is you would think that they would dive and then grab with their talons. And they've done some slow motion photography and discovered that when they come out of the dive, they actually fist their feet and they slam into those birds with those two fists at 200 plus miles an hour, and it stuns the bird out of the sky, at which point they can go and collect it, which is kind of cool to see.
Wow. Remind us what is learned exactly from banding these birds.
Well, we put two bands on each of these chicks, and this is part of a Midwest program that's been going on since the 80s that the states and the provinces in the Midwest have been working together to try to reestablish the species. And one of the bands is what we call a federal band. It comes from the federal government. They're all sequentially numbered. They're really hard to read because they have tiny little numbers on them, but that is something that's recorded by the Fish and Wildlife Service that we can look up from wherever the bird gets recovered. The other one is a color band, which is actually got much larger numbers that are much easier to read from a distance. And so we try to keep an eye to find out where our breeding birds coming from. And this has let us understand a little bit more about the populations of birds in the area. So when we see that we've got a bird that's got a color band that tells us it hatched in Ohio or Minnesota or Hamilton, Ontario, we used to have a Hamilton, Ontario bird in Lansing, it lets us know for these birds, going someplace in the neighborhood may not be 5 miles down the road. It may be 500 miles down the road, and they think of that as the local neighborhood. And so it's really helped us understand what the breeding population really looks like for us.
That's Karen Cleveland, a bird biologist with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. One interesting falcon footnote. Last week, repairmen preparing to reline the interior of the tower building's chimney spotted a lone falcon chick sitting on a ledge down inside of it. Workers lowered a platform with a bit of steak on it to the bird. It hopped on to get at the food and was lifted to safety. Once out of the chimney, the young bird flew off, presumably to a more suitable space. Coming up on Current State, Merz Tate was the first African-American graduate of Western Michigan Teachers College and the first African-American woman to attend Oxford University. Western Michigan University alumna Sonia Bernard Hollins is one of today's leading experts on her life. We'll hear from her coming up on Current State. Don't forget Pop-Up Stories. Our next public storytelling event is 1 week from tonight, Lansing's Allen Marketplace, 5:30 to 7. Storytellers and listeners, the theme is Putting Down Roots. More information at our Current State Facebook page. Families and individuals who are struggling to make ends meet can qualify for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, to meet their nutritional needs, but there are other needs besides food, particularly for women. These SNAP benefits, or food stamps, cannot be used to purchase feminine hygiene products, and this puts a strain on many women and families. Helping Women, Period, was started to help women receive the products they need when they need them. Joining us today for Current State's Neighbors in Action are Amy Stevenson and Lizney Tate. They are co-founders of Helping Women, Period. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
I should say welcome back, actually. And we're also joined by Leah Widener. Leah is a volunteer and special projects coordinator at Haven House East Lansing, which is one of the many charitable partners that receives products from Helping Women, Period. Leah, welcome.
Thank you.
Amy, I'll start with you. Just give us a brief history lesson here on how Helping Women, Period got launched.
In January of 2015, Lizney and I both happened to read the same Huffington Post article, which articulated for us the first time the dire need of feminine hygiene products to the homeless community in particular. And as a result of reading that article, we set out to have a small breakfast to raise some funds and make a quick donation to a few homeless charities. And the response to our request for that breakfast and for fundraising was overwhelming. And from that, our organization was born a year and a half ago. Mm.
Lizney, how exactly do your services work here?
Well, we take orders from local charities. We work with almost 45 charities in the area, and they just tell us what they need, and we use our donations to purchase it from Mishco, and we take it to them, just deliver it.
Yeah. How have these 15 months gone here? Has the organization grown? Has it been a lot of growing pains or what?
It's grown exponentially every month. We've raised more money in the first 6 months of this year than we did the entire year last year. Luckily, Lizney and I have resources of legal, financial, marketing, fundraising folks that have helped us grow and navigate the development of our organization, but it's grown tremendously.
How did this get overlooked? Why did the need grow to the point that it did?
I think people don't like to talk about periods and feminine products, and I think, not to sound sexist, but there's a lot of men in the who make the decisions about what SNAP is, and so I think that's probably a big part of it.
A lot of people assume that it's covered under SNAP, then, is what you're saying?
And a lot of folks, including Lizney and I, have donated to places like Haven House in the past of shampoo, soap. And even we didn't think about these items until we read the article. Mm. And then once we did, it was such a glaring need that we realized we had to do something to fill it.
Leah, you work at Haven House. The organization's been here on Current State, Neighbors in Action, before. Remind us what Haven House does.
Haven House is a family homeless shelter in East Lansing, and we are the only shelter in mid-Michigan that allows men to join and teenage boys to join their families when they're seeking housing. And we've been around for a little over 30 years, and we work with about 140 families every year trying to get them into housing.
You've been on board with Helping Women, Period, from the get-go?
Since day one, yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What difference have their services made in the services you provide?
Well, it's a huge difference. I mean, like they mentioned, SNAP doesn't cover these benefits, and our families are in such need of supplemental income and benefits that we don't have budget lines for. So just like we don't have a lot of money to buy diapers for babies, we don't have any money to buy feminine hygiene products. So instead of asking the community for donations when we need them, we're able to supply our families in housing, up to 30 at any given time, and those in shelter with the products that we get from Helping Women, period.
How much of a financial difference can this make? I mean, how much money can these services save a woman or a family?
I mean, it can be upwards of $50 a month. A box of tampons can be $7. And if you have more than one daughter or a woman in your family, that's a lot of money. I mean, we have women with 4 or 5 daughters, dads with daughters. It's a lot of money for our families with a hygiene budget that they might not even have at all, that they have to buy this. And you want to buy it, especially when you have daughters who just want to have that dignity and to feel normal while they're right in school.
Amy, how has it worked out which organizations you work with here?
We've partnered with a lot of charities similar to Haven House that provide alternative housing. We've also partnered with numerous food banks in the area, churches, shelters, and we are reaching out to school districts in the fall so that we can provide these supplies to low-income students in area schools as well.
Mm. Now, is the school piece kind of a new direction for you here? It kind of sounds like it is.
We're sending letters out just to kind of gauge the interest in the storage capacity to see what we can do. We don't want to overpromise and underdeliver. So right now we're just spending the summer to do some fact finding and see what the demand is. But we anticipate it'll be substantial. As Leah said, these teenagers and middle school girls need these items just like any other woman.
Do you feel like how much of the demand, how much pent-up demand have you satisfied in your first year and a half?
A lot. I don't think we have any quantitative, numbers. But it's just amazing. Everybody who I talk to, because I deal with the charities most directly, and they're just so grateful and so amazed that we would offer this. And it takes a while to convince them that we're going to be here.
That's Lizney Tate, one of the co-founders of Helping Women, period. We're also joined by the group's other co-founder, Amy Stevenson. Leah Widener also joins us. Leah is a volunteer and special projects coordinator at Haven House. Helping Women, period, partners with Haven House and many other charities to help women receive feminine hygiene products that they need. Amy, there's a group similar to yours in New York called Racket. And the group's founder is the lead plaintiff in a class action tampon tax lawsuit in New York State. A handful of other states have gotten rid of the so-called tampon tax. Do you follow what's going on here in Michigan regarding this issue?
We do. There's a woman out of Macomb County, District 18, and her name is State Representative Sarah Roberts. And in January, she submitted 3 bills to the House that would waive the tax on tampons, which really does place, back to Leah's case, an undue burden, especially of all women, but of women of low income. So she has 3 bills, one to eliminate the sales tax. The other 2 are to provide tampons free of charge in schools and in all state buildings. So we do track not only the activity in Michigan and just to stay informed about it, but what other states and countries are doing. As a matter of fact, Canada has abolished tax on all feminine hygiene products, as well as 5 or 7 other states throughout the country.
There have been a few bills, I understand, that have been introduced that haven't gone anywhere. What's the hang up there?
Well, that's a good question. They were submitted January 25th of this year and are in the tax committee, I believe, and they have not been scheduled for a hearing yet. So we're curious to see where that will go, and we try to keep our donors and volunteers updated on the state of that legislation. So if that's something you believe in, write into your representatives and share with them that you feel those undue taxes should be waived for these products.
Even President Obama has weighed in on this.
He has.
I'm learning. I didn't know that until yesterday, but now I know it.
He's a smart man for many reasons, but in his response of what he thought about the tax, it's considered a luxury, and so therefore it's taxed, unlike medical items such as Viagra, which are not taxed. And his response was, well, I think Michelle would care to disagree that that's considered a luxury, and he left it at that.
Okay. Leah, what does it mean to these families you work with at Haven House to receive these products?
It means a great deal. I was actually able to get in touch with a mom yesterday who has 4 daughters, all in middle or high school. And I spoke to one of her daughters. And she remembers when she didn't have to ask for these things. And just like asking for clothes when you grow or things like that, she feels bad because she knows her mom struggles. She's living on limited income and her daughter's too young to work. I mean, we have a lot of women who just don't have the ability to go out to the store and spend $7 and not think about it.
Yeah.
That can be a big part of their budget. And for her to feel normal like anyone else, you know, a lot of us don't have to think. We just had those things. But to have to feel bad about asking your mom to purchase but not having to think about that anymore makes a really big difference for our families. And we're just so glad that we're able to provide those items because of partnerships that we create, like with Helping Women, period.
Lizney, what is your hope for the organization? Do you is there are you still in growth mode here?
Yes.
Okay.
We could easily there's need all over the state, and just we concentrate just on the three counties right now: Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton. We do a little bit in Shiawassee, but we haven't done any push, and that's almost it's a full time job between the two of us. And I don't know, we would really like to go further. We do have an affiliate starting in Chicago. So a woman reached out and she said she really wanted to be part of us. And so she's starting her own Helping Women, period, but in the Chicago area.
We tried to talk about volunteers here on Neighbors in Action. It kind of suggests the role that volunteers can play. What do your volunteers do, Amy?
Our volunteers, first of all, are amazing. They have stepped up every day for the last 15, 16 months to support us. And what folks can do who would like to help is you can donate financially, first and foremost, because we get bulk items from Mishco, and so we're able to stretch the dollar quite far as opposed to what you might buy at Target. So for a $50 donation, we can purchase 500 tampons. Mm. But you can also donate product on our website. We have 6 to 7 different drop-off areas. And you can also sew bags if you're in a quilting group or a sewing bag so that we can distribute these items discreetly. We always need bags to put them in. So financial donations, product donations, and especially bags to distribute would be lovely.
Want to thank all of our guests, three guests here in the studio today. That doesn't happen too often. Amy Stevenson and Lizney Tate are the co-founders of Helping Women, period. We also want to thank Leah Widener, volunteer and special products coordinator at Haven House East Lansing, which is one of the charities that partners with this group to distribute feminine hygiene products to women in need. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you. Continued
luck. Current states looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions. currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State. Tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. This week marks the 75th anniversary of President Roosevelt's Executive Order 8802. That was designed to prohibit racial discrimination in the national defense industry as the U.S. faced imminent war. By any measure, Murs Tate was a trailblazer not only in Michigan but across the U.S. and internationally. Murs Tate was the first African-American graduate of Western Michigan Teachers College and the first African-American woman to attend Oxford University. WKAR's Peter Wharf chatted by phone with Sonia Bernard Hollins, one of today's leading experts on the life of Murs Tate, and she shared a few brief chapters from her rich life.
Murs was an interesting little student. First of all, she started school in a one-room schoolhouse that was built on the back of her family's land. In Roland Township, there was a little elementary school there that her family donated the land to build the school. So she started her schooling off, you know, just going basically in her backyard to school, and then went on to the Blanchard High School, where she walked, I'm hearing anywhere between 3 and 4 miles each way, each day, never missing a day of school. They said on her, and even in her paper, she wrote how she would memorize the Gettysburg Address and, you know, imagine herself in these places around the world through her geography books as she walked to school. So she used that time to teach herself and to learn more about the things that were in her school books. So, you know, on her way to school and back, she used that time wisely and became valedictorian of her high school when she was in 10th grade. The school burnt down, actually, her 10th grade year, and they just graduated all the kids. You know, but most people were fine with that. But Murs did not settle for that. She was the youngest student in that graduating class and went on to Battle Creek Central High School and worked as a maid. She found room and board, you know, at a home in Battle Creek and went there to pay for her room and board as a maid. And even there, she received all A's. Being away from home, and this is before, you know, cell phones or internet where you can't communicate with your parents and, you know, that type of thing. And then, you know, her 11th grade year, she went basically to a different world, you know, going from Small Blanchard, Michigan to Battle Creek, which had the, you know, the Kellogg's there and the Post Tavern and Post Cereal, and it was more of a bigger metropolis compared to her little Blanchard upbringing.
She had this incredible thirst for knowledge that you're pointing out, and a person who was looking way beyond and way ahead to what her life could become. And she took these three incredible steps that you describe in your article about Murs Tate. She went on to Western Michigan University, then took the next step up, in a way, to Radcliffe, which was the Women's College of Harvard University at the time, and then on to Oxford in England. Can you tell us how she made these huge strides?
Well, you got to think, before she was even born, her family, they were amazing. Out of Ohio, there's actually a historical landmark in a town in Ohio based on her family's legacy as Underground Railroad conductors. So they were brave people. She came from a long line of brave people, people who stood up for what they believed in. And as a matter of fact, some of her family from Ohio left during the Homestead Act to come to Michigan and to Mecosta County, where they were the first Negro settlers of Mecosta County. So she came from a line of people who were pioneers in their thinking and in their movement. So she was probably brought up with that, like, you can do it. You can, whatever you want to do, just set your mind to it and don't let limits, you know, stop you. Because her family never let limits stop them. They were pioneers and they were business people and they owned farms, you know, they owned lots of land. They donated land to their communities, you know, for schools and things like that. And, you know, so she was brought up with that mentality that, you know, you can do it. And being in Blanchard, Michigan, her birth certificate said that she was white. She was actually born during a snowstorm. And after the snowstorm was over, the doctor filled out all these birth certificates and just happened to say that, you know, Murs Tate was white. He just filled all these birth certificates out, and she had been white on her birth certificate. And even when she started traveling overseas for her passport application and it said her on her birth certificate that she was white, they said, you need to change this. And she went back to her town. They said, we're not going to change it. And a few of her relatives that I've spoken with since at different reunions said that some of their birth certificates said white as well. And they said that a lot of the people in the town did that to help them get into places when they would leave Blanchard. One of her relatives worked for one of the motor companies in Detroit. And when he sent this information in, they saw him, they said, this isn't you. You know, right. You know this. And he's like, yes, that is me. I said, well, it says here that you're white. It's like, well, no, I'm not, but that's what it says. And it would get them into doors places.
Right.
So it was a very unique situation that her birth certificate said white in her town would not change it. They, you know, even when they had people petition to change it, they would not change her birth certificate. So her town was, you know, they were very forward thinking, you know, even back in 1905, you know, when Murs was born, that not to hold limits on people based on their race. So she grew up with a town supporting her.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Sonia Hollins. She's the writer of a recent article for Michigan History Magazine about Michigan native Murs Tate. Is it possible that she gathered intelligence for the U.S. government during around World War II?
And that's what we're finding out. There's a lot of information that I've been researching that I learned about her, a lot of information that's still classified, a lot of documents that I went to research that are still classified on her. So she was in a lot of areas, and to think of her being an African-American woman who was technically a history professor, you know, at a black college, she would be the perfect spy, you know, who would suspect her. She spoke five languages. She was at one of Hitler's first rallies, you know, in Germany. She understood what he was saying, and she told her family members that was the most frightening experience she ever had in her life, to hear the hate that he had you know, in him and the things that he had said he was going to do. So she was very much so into political areas, political arenas. And like I said, a lot of information has been classified. So I'm still trying to figure out exactly what she was doing. But she was definitely involved.
Merz Tate, Citizen of the World, is the title of the recent article in Michigan History Magazine by Sonia Bernard Hollins, the Kalamazoo native and publisher of the online and print magazine Community Voices. Sonia, thanks very much for taking the time to talk about Merz Tate today.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's Current State for today. We're glad you could join us. Peter Worf is the executive producer of Current State. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thank you, Katie. Also, thanks to Kevin Lavery, Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to technician Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. It's your informative, insightful. It's your indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Covering all the bases, the Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Again, thanks for joining us today. It's Current State on WKAR.